Chapter 38. The Death of Dinosaurs. Life turns up everywhere it can. Life turns up everywhere it can't. And just when it seems to have got itself going really comfortably, with a sustainable lifestyle and gradual progress towards higher things, along comes a major catastrophe and sets it back 20 million years. Yet, paradoxically, those same disasters also pave the way to radically new life forms. It's all rather confusing. Life is resilient, but any particular species may not be. Life is constantly devising new tricks. The one with eggs is brilliant. Provide the developing embryo with its own personal life support machine. Inside, the environment is tailored to the needs of that species, and what's outside doesn't matter much, because there's a barrier to keep it out. Life is adaptable. It changes the rules of its own game. As soon as eggs make their appearance, the stage is set for the evolution of egg eaters. Life is diverse. The more players there are, the more ways there are to make a living, by taking in each other's washing. Life is repetitious. When it finds a trick that works, it churns out thousands of variations on the same basic theme. The great biologist, John J.B.S. Haldane, was once asked what question he would like to pose to God, and he replied that he'd like to know why he has such an inordinate fondness for beetles. Readers of the Discworld book The Last Continent will recall that, by an amazing coincidence, beetles were something of a passion for the god of evolution. There are a third of a million beetle species today, far more than in any other plant or animal group. In 1998, Brian Farrell came up with a possible answer to Haldane's query. Beetles appeared about 250 million years ago, but the number of species didn't explode until about 100 million years ago. That happens to be just when flowering plants came into existence. The phase space available for organisms suddenly acquired a new dimension. A new resource became available for exploitation. The beetles were beautifully poised to take advantage by eating the new plants, especially their leaves. It used to be thought that flowering plants and pollinating insects drove each other to wilder and wilder diversity, but that's not true. However, it is true for beetles. Nearly half of today's beetle species are leaf eaters. It's still an effective tactic. Sometimes, natural disasters don't just eliminate a species or two. The fossil record contains a number of mass extinctions, in which a substantial proportion of all life on Earth disappeared. The best-known mass extinction is the death of the dinosaurs, 65 million years ago. In order not to mislead you, we should point out at once that there is no scientific evidence for the existence of any dinosaur civilization, no matter what events are going on in the Round World Project. But, whenever a scientist says, there is no scientific evidence for, there are three important questions you should ask, especially if it's a government scientist. These are, is there any evidence against, has anyone looked, and, if they did, would they expect to find anything? The answers here are no, no, and no. Rincewind would add some more. Is it safe? Are you sure? Are you absolutely sure? Deep time hides a lot, especially when it's assisted by continental movement, the bulldozing ice sheets, volcanic action, and the occasional doomed asteroid. There are few surviving human artifacts more than 10,000 years old, and if we died out today, the only evidence of our civilization that might survive for a million years would be a few dead probes in deep space and various bits of debris on the moon. 65 million? Not a chance. So although a dinosaurian civilization is pure fantasy, or rather, pure speculation, we can't rule it out absolutely. As for dinosaurs who were sufficiently advanced to use tools, herd other dinosaurs, well, deep time would wash over them without a ripple. Dinosaurs are always among the most popular exhibits at museums. They remind us that the world wasn't always like it is now, and they remind us that humans have been on this planet for a very short time, geologically speaking. Basically, dinosaurs are ancient lizards. The ones whose bones we all go to gawp at in museums are rather big lizards, but many were much smaller. The name means terrible lizard, and anyone who watched Jurassic Park will understand why. An Italian fossil collector who watched the Spielberg movie suddenly realized that a perplexing fossil, filed away for years in his basement, might well be a bit of a dinosaur. He then sent it to a nearby university, where it was found not just to be a dinosaur, but a new species. It was a young theropod, small, flesh-eating dinosaurs that are the closest relatives of birds. Interestingly, it didn't have any feathers. A story straight out of the movies. Narrative imperative at work in our own world. Traceable, as always, to selective reporting. How many fossil hunters owned a bit of dinosaur bone, but didn't make the connection after seeing the movie? In the human mind, dinosaurs resonate with myths about dragons, common to many cultures and many times, and many miles of suggestions have appeared to explain how the dragon thoughts in our minds have come down to us over millions of years of evolution from real dinosaur images and fears in the minds of our ancient ancestors. However, those ancestors must have been very ancient, for those of our ancestors that overlapped the dinosaurs were probably tiny, shrew-like creatures that lived in holes and ate insects. After more than 100 million years of success, the dinosaurs all died out 65 million years ago, and the evidence is that their demise was sudden. Did proto-shrews have nightmares about dinosaurs all that time ago? Could such nightmares have survived 65 million years of natural selection? In particular, do shrews today have nightmares about fire-breathing dragons, or is it just us? It seems likely that the dragon myth comes from other, less literal tendencies of that dark, history-laden organ that we call the human mind. Dinosaurs exert a timeless fascination, especially for children. Dinosaurs are genuine monsters. They actually existed. And some of them, the ones we all know about, were gigantic. They're also safely dead. Many small children, even if they are resistant to the standard reading materials in school, can reel off a long list of dinosaur names. Velociraptor was not notable among them before Jurassic Park, but it is now. Those of us who still have an affection for the brontosaur often need to be reminded that for silly reasons, science has deemed that, henceforth, that sinuous swamp-dwelling giant must be renamed the Apatosaur. A worse case is what used to be called Eohippus, the Dawn Horse, a beautiful poetic name for the animal that formed the main stem of the horse's family tree. It is now called Hyracotherium, because somewhat earlier somebody had given that name to a creature that they thought was a relative of the Hyrax, represented by a single fossil shoulder blade. Then it turned out that the bone was actually part of Eohippus. Unfortunately, whoever officially names a species first must get priority, so now the Dawn Horse has a silly, unpoetic name that commemorates a mistake. We lost Brontosaurus, Thunder Lizard, for a similar reason. Thunder Lizard? What a marvellous name! Apatosaurus? It probably means gravitationally challenged lizard. The moral of this tale is that when learned committees of elderly scientists meet to discuss an exceptional issue, they can always be trusted to make a completely ridiculous decision. Quite unlike the wizards of Unseen University, naturally. So attuned are we to the dinosaurs that the drama of their sudden disappearance has captured our imaginations more than any other bit of paleontology. Even our own origins attract less media attention. What about the sudden demise? For a start, quite a few scientists have disputed that it ever was sudden. The fossil record implicates the end of the Cretaceous period, 65 million years ago, as D-Day. This was also the start of the so-called Tertiary period, or Age of Mammals, so the end of dinosaurs is usually called the K-T boundary. K, because Germans spell Cretaceous with a K. But if we assume that the end of the Cretaceous was when it happened, then many species seem to have anticipated their end by vanishing from the fossil records 5 to 10 million years earlier. Did amorous dinosaurs perhaps say to each other, "It's just not worth going through with this reproduction business, dear"? We're all going to be wiped out in 10 million years. No. So why the fuzzy fade-out over millions of years? There are good statistical reasons why we might not be able to locate fossils right up to the end, even if the species concerned were still alive. To set the remark in context, how many specimens of Tyrannosaurus rex, the most famous dinosaur of all, do you think that the world's universities and museums have between them? Not copies, but originals, dug from the rock by paleontologists. Hundreds, surely. No, until Jurassic Park, there were precisely 3. At the times when those particular animals lived, have a spread of 5 million years. 90 more fossilized T-Rexes have been found since, probably more by the time you listen to this, because Jurassic Park gave dinosaurs a lot of favorable publicity, making it possible to drum up enough money to go out and find some more. With that rate of success, the chance of a future race finding any fossil humanoids over the whole period of our and our ancestors' existence would be negligible. So if some species has survived on Earth for a 5 million year period, it is entirely likely that no fossils of it will have been found, especially if it lived on dry land, where fossils seldom form. This may suggest that the fossil record isn't much use, but quite the contrary applies. Every fossil that we find is proof positive that the corresponding species did actually exist. Moreover, we can get a pretty accurate impression of the grand flow of life from an incomplete sample. One lizard fossil is enough to establish the presence of lizards, even if we found only one species out of the 10,000 that were around. Bearing this in mind, though, we can easily see that even if the death of the dinosaurs was extremely sudden, then the fossil record might easily give a different impression. Suppose that fossils of a given species turn up randomly about every 5 million years. Sometimes they're like buses, and 3 come along at once, that is, within 1 million years of each other. Other times they're also like buses. You wait all day, 10 million years, and don't see any at all. During the 10 million year run-up to the KT boundary, you find random fossils. For some species, the last one you find is from 75 million years ago. For others, it's from 70 million years ago. For a few, by chance, it's from 65 million years ago. So you seem to see a gradual fade-out. Unfortunately, you'd see much the same if there really had been a gradual fade-out. How can you tell the difference? You should look at species whose fossils are far more common. If the demise was a sudden one, those ought to show a sharper cut-off. Species that live wholly or partially in water get fossilized more often, so the best way to time the KT mass extinction is to look at fossils of marine species. Wise scientists, therefore, mostly ignore the dinosaur drama and fiddle around with tiny snails and other undramatic species instead. When they do, they find that Ichthyosaurus also died out about then, as did the last of the ammonites, and many other marine groups. Lots of ammonite species died out 5 to 10 million years before the KT boundary, so it looks as if their extinction genuinely was gradual. But whatever it was that happened at the KT boundary finished them off. So something sudden and dramatic really did happen at the actual boundary. But there may well have been a succession of other events just before it, too. What kind of drama? An important clue comes from deposits of iridium, a rare metal in the Earth's crust. Iridium is distinctly more common in some meteorites, particularly those from the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. So if you find an unusually rich deposit of iridium on Earth, then it may well have come from an impacting meteorite. In 1979, the Nobel-winning physicist Luis Alvarez was musing along such lines, and he and his geologist son, Walter Alvarez, discovered a layer of clay that contains 100 times as much iridium as normal. It was laid down right at the KT boundary, and it can be found over the whole of the Earth's landmass. The Alvarezes interpreted this discovery as a strong hint that a meteorite impact caused the KT extinction. The total amount of iridium in the layer is estimated to be around 200,000 tons, which is about the amount you'd expect to find in a meteorite 6 miles, 10 kilometers, across. If a meteorite that size were to hit the Earth, travelling at a typical 10 miles per second, 16 kilometers per second, it would leave an impact crater 40 miles, 65 kilometers, in diameter. The blast would have been equivalent to thousands of hydrogen bombs. It would have thrown enormous quantities of dust into the atmosphere, blanking out sunlight for years, and if it happened to hit the ocean, a better than 50-50 chance, it would cause huge tidal waves and a short-lived burst of superheated steam. Plants would die, large plant-eating dinosaurs would run out of food and die too, carnivorous dinosaurs would quickly follow. Insects would, on the whole, fare a little better, as would insect eaters. Much evidence has accumulated that the Chicxulub crater, a buried rock formation in the Yucatan region of southern Mexico, is the remnant of this impact. Crystals of shocked quartz were spread far and wide from the impact site. The biggest ones are found near the crater, the smaller ones are found halfway round the world. In 1998, a piece of the actual meteorite, a tenth of an inch, 2.5 millimeters across, was found in the North Pacific Ocean by Frank Kite. The fragment looks like part of an asteroid, ruling out a possible alternative, a comet, which might also create a similar crater. According to A. Shikolyakov and G. W. Lugmeier, the proportions of chromium isotopes in KT sediment confirm that view. And Andrew Smith and Charlotte Jeffrey have found that mass diebacks of sea urchins, which occurred at the KT boundary, were worst in the regions around Central America, where we think the meteorite came down. Although the evidence for an impact is strong, and has grown considerably over the 20 years since the Alvarez's first advance, their meteorite strike theory, a strongly dissenting group of paleontologists has looked to terrestrial events, not dramatic astronomical interference, to explain the KT extinction. There was certainly a rapid series of climatic changes at the end of the Cretaceous, with very drastic changes of sea level as ice caps grew or melted. There is also good evidence that some seas, perhaps all, lost their oxygen-based ecology to become vast, stinking, black, anaerobic sinks. The fossil evidence for this consists of black iron and sulfur-rich lines in sediments. The most dramatic terrestrial events were undoubtedly associated with the volcanism which resulted in the so-called Deccan traps, huge geological deposits of lava. The whole of Asia seems to have been covered with volcanoes, and they produced enough lava that it would have formed a layer 50 yards, 45 meters thick, if it had been spread over the whole continent. Such extensive volcanism would have had enormous effects on the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide emissions that warmed the atmosphere by the greenhouse effect, sulfur compounds resulting in terrible acid rain and freshwater pollution over the entire planet, and tiny rock particles blocking sunlight and causing nuclear winters for decades at a time. Could the volcanoes that formed the Deccan traps have killed the dinosaurs instead of a meteorite? Much depends on the timing. Our preferred theory, not because there is good independent evidence for it, but because it would explain so much, and because it has a moral, is that the two causes are linked. The Chicxulub crater is very nearly opposite the Deccan traps, on the other side of the planet. Perhaps volcanic activity in Asia began some millions of years before the KT boundary, causing occasional ecological crises for the larger animals, but nothing really final. Then the meteorite hit, causing shockwaves which passed right through the Earth and converged, focused as if by a lens, on just that fragile region of the planet's crust. A similar effect happened on Mercury, where a gigantic impact crater called the Caloris Basin is directly opposite weird terrain, caused by focused shockwaves. There would then have been a gigantic, synchronized burst of volcanism, on top of all the events of the collision, which would have been pretty bad on their own. The combination could have polished off innumerable animal species. In support of this idea, it should be said that another geological deposit, the Siberian Traps, contains 10 times as much lava as the Deccan system, and it so happens that the Siberian traps were laid down at the time of another mass extinction, the Great Permian extinction, which we mentioned earlier. To pile on further evidence, some geologists believe they have found another meteorite impact site in modern Australia, which in Permian times was opposite to Siberia. Is there any evidence for this suggestion? In 2000, Dallas Abbott and Anne Isley analysed impact events to see whether they coincided with volcanic superplumes, where large amounts of liquid rock well up from the Earth's mantle. A superplume is thought to be responsible for the Hawaiian island chain, for instance, whose relics stretch across half the Pacific Ocean. The likely explanation is that the continents drifted, the Pacific plate moved, so that the superplume welled up in what now seems to be different places. However, very recent observations suggest that superplumes can move too. The Deccan and Siberian traps were also probably caused by superplumes. The result of the analysis is that impacts and superplumes occur together far more often than they would if their association is due to chance. That suggests that impacts can make superplumes bigger or more likely. It's hard to see how superplumes could make impacts more likely, except by attracting invading aliens, who are heavily into volcanism. However, thanks to continental drift, it is not certain that the Deccan traps were in fact on the exact far side of the Earth from Chicxulub at the time when the KT meteorite hit, so we can't yet be sure that the meteorite really did trigger massive volcanic activity. The moral of this tale is that we should not look for the cause of the dinosaur extinction. It is very rare for there to be just one cause of a natural event, unlike scientific experiments, which are specially set up to reveal unique explanations. On Discworld, not only does death come for humans, scythe in hand, but diminutive sub-deaths come for other animals. For example, the death of rats in soul music, from whom a single typical quote will suffice. Squeak. The death of dinosaurs would have been something to see, with volcanoes in one hand and asteroids in the other, trailing a cloak of ice. They were wonderfully cinematic reptiles, weren't they? Trust the wizards to get it wrong. There is another lesson to be learned from our emphasis on the demise of the dinosaurs. Many other large and/or dramatic reptiles died out at the end of the Cretaceous, notably the plesiosaurs, famous as possible explanations of the mythical Loch Ness Monster, the ichthyosaurs, enormous fish-shaped predators, reptilian whales and dolphins, the pterosaurs, strange flying forms of which the pterodactyls appear in all the dinosaur films and are labelled wrongly dinosaurs, and especially the mosasaurs. Mosasaurs? What are they? They were as dramatic as the dinosaurs, but they weren't dinosaurs. They didn't have as good a PR firm, though, because few non-specialists have heard of them. They are popularly known as fish lizards, not as good a name as terrible lizard, and it describes them well. Some were nearly as fish-like as ichthyosaurs or dolphins. Some were rather crocodile-like. Some were 50-foot predators, like the great white shark. Some were just a couple of feet long and fed on baby ammonites and other common mollusks. They lasted a good 20 million years, and for much of that time, they seem to have been the dominant marine predators. Yet most people meet the word in stories about dinosaurs, assume that the mosasaur was a not very interesting kind of dinosaur, and promptly forget them. The other really strange thing about the KT extinction, probably not a thing in any meaningful sense, because in this context a thing would be an equation of unknowns, whereas what we have is a diversity of related puzzles, is which creatures survived it. In the sea, the ammonites all died out, as did the other shelled forms like belemnites, unrolled ammonites, but the nautilus came through, as did cuttlefish, squids, and octopuses. Amazingly, the crocodiles, which to our eyes are about as dinosaur-like as you can get without actually being one, survived the KT event with little loss of diversity. Those little dinosaurs, called birds, came through pretty well unscathed. There's a story here that we need to tell quickly, Not so long ago, the idea that birds are the living remnants of the dinosaurs was new, controversial, and therefore a hot topic. Then it rapidly turned into the prevailing wisdom. New fossil discoveries, however, have shown conclusively that the major families of modern birds diverged in an evolutionary sense long before the KT event. So they aren't remnants of the dinosaurs that otherwise died. They got out early, by ceasing to be dinosaurs at all. Myths, not least Jurassic Park itself, have suggested that dinosaurs are not really extinct at all. They survive, or so semi-fact, semi-fiction accounts lead us to believe, in Lost World South American valleys, on uninhabited islands, in the depths of Loch Ness, on other planets, or, more mystically, as DNA preserved inside blood-sucking insects trapped and encased in amber. Alas, almost certainly not. In particular, ancient DNA, reportedly extracted from insects fossilized in amber, comes from modern contaminants, not prehistoric organisms, at least if the amber is more than 100,000 years old. Significantly, no one has made a film bringing back dodos, moas, pygmy elephants, or mosasaurs. Only dinosaurs and Hitler are popular for the reawakening myth. Both, at the same time, would be a good trick. Dinosaurs are the ultimate icon for an evolutionary fact which we generally ignore and definitely find uncomfortable to think about. Nearly all species that have ever existed are extinct. As soon as we realize that, we are forced to look at conservation of animal species in new ways. Does it really matter that the lesser spotted pogo bird is down to its last 100 specimens? Or that 100 species of tree snail on a Pacific island have been eaten out of existence by predators introduced by human activity? Some issues, like the importation of Nile perch into Lake Victoria in order to improve the game fishing, which has resulted in the loss of many hundreds of fascinating cichlid fish species, are regretted even by the people responsible, if only because the new lake ecosystem seems to be much less productive. Everyone, except purveyors of bizarre ancient medicines, their even more foolish customers, and some unreconstructed barbarians, seem to agree that the loss of magnificent creatures like the great whales, elephants, rhinos, and of course plants like ginkgos and sequoias would be a tragedy. Nevertheless, we persist in reducing the diversity of species in ecosystems all around the planet, losing many species of beetles and bacteria with hardly any regrets. From the point of view of the majority of humans, there are good species, unimportant species, and bad species like smallpox and mosquitoes, which we would clearly be better off without. Unless you take an extreme view on the rights of all living creatures to a continued existence, you find yourself having to pass judgment about which species should be conserved. And if you do take such an extreme view, you've got a real problem trying to preserve the rights of cheetahs and those of their prey, such as gazelles. On the other hand, if you take the task of passing judgment seriously, you can't just assume that, say, mosquitoes are bad and should be eliminated. Ecosystems are dynamic, and the loss of a species in one place may cause unexpected trouble elsewhere. You have to examine the unintended consequences of your methods, as well as the intended ones. When worldwide efforts were made to eradicate mosquitoes, with the aim of getting rid of malaria, the preferred route was mass sprayings of the insecticide DDT. For a time, this appeared to be working, but the result in the medium term was to destroy all manner of beneficial insects and other creatures, and to produce resistant strains of mosquitoes, which, if anything, were worse than their predecessors. DDT is now banned worldwide, which, unfortunately, doesn't stop some people continuing to use it. In the past, the environment was a context for us. We evolved to suit it. Now we've become a context for the environment. We change it to suit us. We need to learn how to do that. But going back to some imaginary golden age in which primitive humans allegedly lived in harmony with nature isn't the answer. It may not be politically correct to say so, that most primitive humans did as much environmental damage as their puny technology would allow. When humans came to the Americas from Siberia by way of Alaska, they slaughtered their way right down to the tip of South America in a few thousand years, wiping out dozens of species. Giant tree sloths and mastodons, ancient elephants like mammoths but different, for example. Some scientists have disagreed with this interpretation, claiming that humans could never have made that great an impact. In 2001, to test that claim, John Allroy simulated the effect of hunting in computer models of 41 North American species. It turned out that extinctions were virtually unavoidable, especially for the larger animals. Even highly incompetent hunters would have wiped them out. The simulations correctly post-dicted the fate of 32 of the 41 species, which adds credibility to their conclusions. Who done it? New Scientist asked, offering its own suggestion. Mr. Sapiens, in the Americas, with a large axe. There have been many similar examples of ecological devastation wrought by primitive humans. The Anasazi Indians in the southern part of today's USA cut down forests to build their cliff dwellings, creating some of the most arid areas of the United States. The Maoris killed off the Moas. Modern humans may be even more destructive, but there are more of us, and technology can amplify our actions. Nevertheless, by the time humans were able to articulate the term natural environment, there wasn't one. We had changed the face of continents in ways big and small. To live in harmony with nature, we must know how to sing the same song as nature. To do that, we must understand nature. Good intentions aren't enough. Science might be, if we use it wisely.